Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you two more stories by Catherine Mansfield, Bliss and Marriage a la Mode. Both stories are about marriages, one from a man's perspective and one from a woman's. It is interesting that Mansfield would choose to write on the subject. Her experience of marriage was fleeting. She hastily entered into a marriage with George Bowden, a teacher of singing 11 years her senior. She left him the same evening before the marriage could be consummated. Mansfield had two romantic relationships with women that are notable for their prominence in her journal entries. She continued to have male lovers and attempted to repress her feelings at certain times. And now, Bliss by Catherine Mansfield. Although Bertha Young was 30, she still had moments like this when she wanted to run instead of walk, to take dancing steps on and off the pavement, to bowl a hoop, to throw something up in the air and catch it again, or to stand still and laugh at nothing simply. What can you do if you are 30 and turning the corner of your own street, you are overcome suddenly by a feeling of bliss, absolute bliss, as though you'd suddenly swallowed a bright piece of that late afternoon sun, and it burned in your bosom, sending out a little shower of sparks into every particle, into every finger and toe. Oh, there is no way you can express it without being drunk and disorderly. How idiotic civilization is! Why be given a body if you have to keep it shut up in a case, like a rare, rare fiddle? No, that about the fiddle is not quite what I mean, she thought, running up the steps and feeling in her bag for the key. She'd forgotten it as usual, and rattling the letterbox. It's not what I mean, because... Thank you, Mary. She went into the hall. Is the nurse back?
Yes, Mum.
And has the fruit come?
Yes, Mum. Everything's come.
Bring the fruit up to the dining room, will you? I'll arrange it before I go upstairs. It was dusky in the dining room and quite chilly, but all the same, Bertha threw off her coat. She could not bear the tight clasp of it another moment, and the cold air fell on her arms. But in her bosom there was still that bright, glowing place, that shower of little sparks coming from it. It was almost unbearable. She hardly dared to breathe for fear of fanning it higher, and yet she breathed deeply, deeply. She hardly dared to look into the cold mirror, but she did look, and it gave her back a woman radiant with smiling, trembling lips, with big dark eyes and an air of listening, waiting for something divine to happen, that she knew must happen infallibly. Mary brought in the fruit on a tray, and with it a glass bowl and a blue dish, very lovely, with a strange sheen on it, as though it had been dipped in milk.
"Shall I turn on the light, Mum?"
"No, thank you. I can see quite well." There were tangerines and apples stained with strawberry pink, some yellow pears smooth as silk, some white grapes covered with a silver bloom, and a big cluster of purple ones. These last she had bought to tone in with the new dining room carpet. Yes, that did sound rather far-fetched and absurd, but it was really why she had bought them. She had thought in the shop, "I must have some purple ones to bring the carpet up to the table," and it had seemed quite sensible at the time. When she had finished with them and had made two pyramids of these bright round shapes, she stood away from the table to get the effect, and it really was most curious, for the dark table seemed to melt into the dusky light, and the glass dish and the blue bowl to float in the air. This, of course, in her present mood, was so incredibly beautiful. She began to laugh. "No, no, I'm getting hysterical." And she seized her bag and coat and ran upstairs to the nursery. Nurse sat at a low table, giving little Bee her supper after her bath. The baby had on a white flannel gown and a blue woolen jacket, and her dark, fine hair was brushed up into a funny little peak. She looked up when she saw her mother and began to jump.
"Now, my lovey, eat it up like a good girl," said nurse, setting her lips in a way that Bertha knew, and that meant she had come into the nursery at another wrong moment. Has she been good, Nanny? She's been a little sweet all afternoon, whispered Nanny. We went to the park, and I sat down on a chair and took her out of the pram, and a big dog came along and put his head on my knee, and she clutched its ear, tugged it. Oh, you should have seen her.
Bertha wanted to ask if it wasn't rather dangerous to let her clutch at a strange dog's ear, but she did not dare to. She stood watching them, her hands by her side, like the poor little girl in front of the rich little girl with the doll. The baby looked at her again, stared, and then smiled so charmingly that Bertha couldn't help crying.
Oh, Nanny, do let me finish giving her her supper while you put the bath things away.
Well, Mum, she oughtn't to be changed hands while she's eating, said Nanny, still whispering. It unsettles her. It's very likely to upset her.
How absurd it was. Why have a baby if it was to be kept not in a case like a rare, rare fiddle, but in another woman's arms?
Oh, I must, said she.
Very offended, Nanny handed her over.
Now, don't excite her after her supper. You know you do, Mum, and I have such a time with her after.
Thank heaven, Nanny went out of the room with the bath towels.
Now I've got you to myself, my little precious, said Bertha, as the baby leaned against her.
She ate delightfully, holding up her lips for the spoon and then waving her hands. Sometimes she would let the spoon go, and sometimes, just as Bertha had filled it, she waved it away to the four winds. When the soup was finished, Bertha turned round to the fire.
You're nice. You're very nice, said she, kissing her warm baby. I'm fond of you. I like you.
And indeed, she loved little Bee so much, her neck as she bent forward, her exquisite toes as they shone transparent in the firelight, that all her feeling of bliss came back again, and again she didn't know how to express it, what to do with it.
You're wanted on the telephone,
said Nanny, coming back in triumphant and seizing her little Bee. Down she flew. It was Harry.
Oh, is that you, Burr? Look here, I'll be late. I'll take a taxi and come along as quickly as I can. But get dinner put back 10 minutes, will you? All right?
Yes, perfectly. Oh, Harry.
Yes?
What had she to say? She had nothing to say. She only wanted to get in touch with him for a moment. She couldn't absurdly cry, "Hasn't it been a divine day?"
"What is it?"
rapped out the little voice.
"Nothing. Entendu,"
said Bertha, and hung up the receiver, thinking how much more idiotic civilization was. They had people coming to dinner. The Norman Knights, a very sound couple. He was about to start a theater, and she was awfully keen on interior decoration. A young man, Eddie Warren, who had just published a little book of poems, and who everybody was asking to dine, and a find of Bertha's called Pearl Fulton. What Miss Fulton did, Bertha did not know. They had met at the club, and Bertha had fallen in love with her, as she always did fall in love with beautiful women who had something strange about them. The provoking thing was that although they had been about together and met a number of times and really talked, Bertha couldn't make her out. Up to a certain point, Miss Fulton was rarely wonderfully frank, but the certain point was there, and beyond that she would not go. Was there anything beyond it?
Harry said no.
Voted her dullish and cold like a blonde woman with a touch, perhaps, of anemia of the brain. But Bertha wouldn't agree with him. Not yet, at any rate.
No, the way she has of sitting with her hand a little on one side and smiling has something behind it, Harry, and I must find out what that something is.
Most likely a good stomach, answered Harry.
He made a point of catching Bertha's heels with replies of that kind.
Liver frozen, my dear girl, or pure flatulence, or kidney disease.
And so on. For some strange reason, Bertha liked this, and almost admired it in him very much. She went into the drawing room and lighted the fire. Then picking up the cushions one by one that Mary had disposed so carefully, she threw them back on the chairs and the couches. That made all the difference. The room came alive at once. As she was about to throw the last one, she surprised herself by suddenly hugging it to her, passionately, passionately. But it did not put out the fire in her bosom. Oh, on the contrary! The windows of the drawing room opened onto a balcony overlooking the garden. At the far end against the wall, there was a tall, slender pear tree, in fullest, richest bloom. It stood perfect, as though becalmed against the jade-green sky. Bertha couldn't help feeling, even from this distance, that it had not a single bud or a faded petal. Down below in the garden beds, the red and yellow tulips, heavy with flowers, seemed to lean upon the dusk. A gray cat, dragging its belly, crept across the lawn, and a black one, its shadow, trailed after. The sight of them, so intent and so quick, gave Bertha a curious shiver. "What a creepy thing cats are," she stammered, and she turned away from the window and began walking up and down. How strong the jonquil smelled in the warm room! Too strong? Oh, no! And yet, as though overcome, she flung down on a couch and pressed her hands to her eyes. "I'm too happy, too happy," she murmured. And she seemed to see on her eyelids the lovely pear tree, with its wide-open blossoms as a symbol of her own life. Really, really, she had everything. She was young, Harry and she were as much in love as ever, and they got on together splendidly and were really good pals. She had an adorable baby. They didn't have to worry about money. They had this absolutely satisfactory house and garden. And friends. Modern, thrilling friends. Writers and painters and poets, or people keen on social questions. Just the kind of friends they wanted. And then there were books, and there was music, and she had found a wonderful little dressmaker, and they were going abroad in the summer, and their new cook made the most superb omelets. I'm absurd, absurd. She sat up, but she felt quite dizzy, quite drunk. It must have been the spring. Yes, it was the spring. Now she was so tired she could not drag herself upstairs to dress. A white dress, a string of jade beads, green shoes and stockings. It wasn't intentional. She had thought of this scheme hours before she stood at the drawing-room window. Her petals rustled softly into the hall, and she kissed Mrs. Norman Knight, who was taking off the most amusing orange coat with a procession of black monkeys round the hem and up the fronts.
Why is the middle class so stodgy, so utterly without a sense of humor? My dear, it's only by a fluke that I'm here at all, Norman being the protective fluke. For my darling monkeys so upset the train that it rose to a man and simply ate me with its eyes. Didn't laugh, wasn't amused, that I should have loved. No, just stared and bored me through and through.
But the cream of it was,
said Norman, pressing a large tortoiseshell-rimmed monocle to his eye.
You don't mind me telling this face, do you?
In their home and among their friends, they called each other Face and Mug.
The cream of it was when she, being full-fed, turned to the woman beside her and said, Haven't you ever seen a monkey before?
Oh, yes, Mrs. Norman Knight joined in the laughter. Wasn't that too absolutely creamy?
And a funnier thing still was that now her coat was off, and she did look like a very intelligent monkey who had even made that yellow silk dress out of scraped banana skins, and her amber earrings, they were like little dangling nuts.
This is a sad, sad fall,
said Mug, pausing in front of Little Bee's perambulator.
When the perambulator comes into the hall.
And he waved the rest of the quotation away. The bell rang. It was lean, pale Eddie Warren, as usual, in a state of acute distress.
It is the right house, isn't it?
He pleaded.
Oh, I think so. I hope so, said Bertha, brightly.
I have had such a dreadful experience with the taxi man. He was most sinister. I couldn't get him to stop. The more I knocked and called, the faster he went.
and in the moonlight this bizarre figure with a flattened head crouching over the little wheel.
He shuddered, taking off an immense white silk scarf. Bertha noticed that his socks were white, too. Most charming.
"But how dreadful!" she cried.
"Yes, it really was,"
said Eddie, following her into the drawing room.
"I saw myself driving through eternity in a timeless taxi."
He knew the Norman Knights. In fact, he was going to write a play for N.K. when the theater scheme came off.
"Well, Warren, how's the play?"
said Norman Knight, dropping his monocle and giving his eye a moment in which to rise to the surface before it was screwed down again. And Mrs. Norman Knight,
"Oh, Mr. Warren, what happy socks!"
"I'm so glad you like them,"
he said, staring at his feet.
"They seem to have got so much whiter since the moon rose."
And he turned his lean, sorrowful young face to Bertha.
"There is a moon, you know."
She wanted to cry. "I am sure there is. Often, often." He really was the most attractive person, but so was Face, crouched before the fire in her banana skins, and so was Mug, smoking a cigarette, and saying as he flicked the ashes,
"Why doth the bridegroom tarry?"
"There he is now." Bang went the front door open and shut. Harry shouted,
"Hello, people! Down in 5 minutes."
And they heard him swarm up the stairs. Bertha couldn't help smiling. She knew how he loved doing things at high pressure. What, after all, did an extra 5 minutes matter? But he would pretend to himself that they mattered beyond measure. And then he would make a great point of coming into the drawing room extravagantly cool and collected. Harry had such a zest for life. Oh, how she appreciated it in him, and his passion for fighting, for seeking in everything that came up against him another test of his power and of his courage. That, too, she understood, even when it made him just occasionally to other people who didn't know him well, a little ridiculous, perhaps. For there were moments when he rushed into battle where no battle was. She talked and laughed and positively forgot, until he came in, just as she had imagined, that Pearl Fulton had not turned up. "I wonder if Miss Fulton has forgotten?"
"I expect so," said Harry. "Is she on the phone?"
"Ah, there's a taxi now." And Bertha smiled with that little air of proprietorship that she always assumed while her women finds were new and mysterious. "She lives in taxis."
"She'll run to fat if she does,"
said Harry coolly, ringing the bell for dinner.
"Frightful danger for blonde women."
"Harry, don't," warned Bertha, laughing up at him. Came another tiny moment while they waited, laughing and talking, just a trifle too much at their ease, a trifle too unaware. And then Miss Fulton, all in silver, with a silver fillet binding her pale blonde hair, came in smiling, her head a little on one side.
"Am I late?"
"No, not at all," said Bertha. "Come along." And she took her arm, and they moved into the dining room. What was there in the touch of that cool arm that could fan, start blazing, the fire of bliss that Bertha did not know what to do with? Miss Fulton did not look at her, but then she seldom did look at people directly. Her heavy eyelids lay upon her eyes, and the strange half-smile came and went upon her lips, as though she lived by listening rather than seeing. But Bertha knew suddenly, as if the longest, most intimate look had passed between them, as if they had said to each other, "You two?" that Pearl Fulton, stirring the beautiful red soup in the gray plate, was feeling just what she was feeling. And the others? Face and Mug, Eddie and Harry, their spoons rising and falling, dabbing their lips with their napkins, crumbling bread, fiddling with the forks and glasses, and talking.
"I met her at the Alpha Show, the weirdest little person. She'd not only cut off her hair, but she seemed to have taken a dreadfully good snip off her legs and arms, and her neck and her poor little nose as well."
"Isn't she very liege with Michael Oates? The man who wrote Love and False Teeth? He wants to write a play for me. One act, one man. Decides to commit suicide. Gives all the reasons why he should and why he shouldn't. And just as he has made up his mind either to do it or not to do it, curtain. Not half a bad idea."
"What's he going to call it?"
Stomach trouble?
I think I've come across the same idea in a little French review, quite unknown in England.
No, they didn't share it. They were dears, dears, and she loved having them there at her table and giving them delicious food and wine. In fact, she longed to tell them how delightful they were and what a decorative group they made, how they seemed to set one another off, and how they reminded her of a play by Chekhov. Harry was enjoying his dinner. It was part of his, well, not his nature exactly, and certainly not his pose. His something or other, to talk about food and to glory in on his shameless passion for the white flesh of the lobster, and the green pistachio ices, green and cold like the eyelids of Egyptian dancers. When he looked up at her and said,
"Bertha, this is a very admirable soufflé."
She almost could have wept with childlike pleasure. Oh, why did she feel so tender towards the whole world tonight? Everything was good, was right. All that happened seemed to fill again her brimming cup of bliss. And still, in the back of her mind, there was the pear tree. It would be silver now in the light of poor dear Eddie's moon, silver as Miss Fulton, who sat there turning a tangerine in her slender fingers that were so pale a light seemed to come from them. What she simply couldn't make out, what was miraculous, was how she should have guessed Miss Fulton's mood so exactly and so instantly, for she never doubted for a moment that she was right, and yet what had she to go on? Less than nothing. I believe this does happen very, very rarely between women, never between men, thought Bertha. But while I'm making the coffee in the drawing room, perhaps she will give a sign. What she meant by that she did not know, and what would happen after that she could not imagine. While she thought like this, she saw herself talking and laughing. She had to talk because of her desire to laugh. I must laugh or die. But when she noticed Face's funny little habit of tucking something down the front of her bodice, as if she'd kept a tiny secret hoard of nuts there, too, Bertha had to dig her nails into her hands so as not to laugh too much. It was over at last, and, "Come and see my new coffee machine," said Bertha.
"We only have a new coffee machine once a fortnight," said Harry.
Face took her arm this time. Miss Fulton bent her head and followed after. The fire had died down in the drawing room to a red, flickering
nest of baby phoenixes, said Face.
"Don't turn up the light for a moment. It is so lovely." And down she crouched by the fire again. She was always cold. Without her little red flannel jacket, of course, thought Bertha. At that moment, Miss Fulton gave the sign.
"Have you a garden?" said the cool, sleepy voice.
This was so exquisite on her part that all Bertha could do was to obey. She crossed the room, pulled the curtains apart, and opened the long windows. "There," she breathed. And the two women stood side by side, looking at the slender, flowering tree. Although it was so still, it seemed like the flame of a candle to stretch up, to point, to quiver in the bright air, to grow taller and taller as they gazed, almost to touch the rim of the round silver moon. How long did they stand there, both, as it were, caught in that circle of unearthly light, understanding each other perfectly, creatures of another world, and wondering what they were to do in this one with all this blissful treasure that burned in their bosoms and dropped in silver flowers from their hair and hands. Forever, for a moment, and did Miss Fulton murmur,
"Yes, just that."
Or did Bertha dream it? Then the light was snapped on, and Face made the coffee, and Harry said,
"My dear Mrs. Knight, don't ask me about my baby. I never see her. I shan't feel the slightest interest in her until she has a lover."
And Mug took his eye out of the conservatory for a moment, and then put it under glass again, and Eddie Warren drank his coffee, and set down the cup with a face of anguish, as though he had drunk and seen the spider.
"What I want to do is give the young men a show. I believe London is simply teeming with first-chop unwritten plays. What I want to say to him is, here's the theatre, fire ahead.
You know, my dear, I'm going to decorate a room for the Jacob Nathans. Oh, I'm so tempted to do a fried fish scheme, with the backs of the chairs shaped like frying pans, and lovely chipped potatoes embroidered all over the curtains.
The trouble with our young writing men is that they're still too romantic. You can't put out to sea without being seasick and wanting a basin. Well, why don't they have the courage of those basins?
A dreadful poem about a girl who was violated by a beggar without a nose in a little wood.
Miss Fulton sank into the lowest, deepest chair, and Harry handed round the cigarettes. From the way he stood in front of her, shaking the silver box and saying abruptly,
"Egyptian, Turkish, Virginian, they're all mixed up."
Bertha realized that she not only bored him, he really disliked her, and she decided from the way Miss Fulton said, "No, thank you, I won't smoke," that she felt it too and was hurt. "Oh, Harry, don't dislike her. You are quite wrong about her. She's wonderful, wonderful. And besides, how can you feel so differently about someone who means so much to me? I shall try to tell you, when we are in bed tonight, what has been happening, what she and I have shared." At those last words, something strange and almost terrifying darted into Bertha's mind, and this something, blind and smiling, whispered to her, "Soon these people will go. The house will be quiet. Quiet. The lights will be out, and you and he will be alone together in the dark room, the warm bed." She jumped from her chair and ran over to the piano. "What a pity someone does not play," she cried. "What a pity somebody does not play." For the first time in her life, Bertha Young desired her husband. Oh, she loved him. She'd been in love with him, of course, in every other way, but just not in that way. And equally, of course, she understood that he was different. They discussed it so often. It had worried her dreadfully at first to find that she was so cold, but after a time it had not seemed to matter. They were so frank with each other, such good pals. That was the best of being modern. But now, ardently, ardently, the word ached in her ardent body. Was this what that feeling of bliss had been leading up to? But then...
"My dear," said Mrs. Norman Knight, "you know our shame. We are the victims of time and train. We live in Hampstead. It's been so nice."
"I'll come with you into the hall," said Bertha. "I loved having you, but you must not miss the last train. That's so awful, isn't it?"
"Have a whiskey night before you go," called Harry. "No thanks, old chap."
Bertha squeezed his hand for that as she shook it. "Good night, goodbye," she cried from the top step, feeling that this self of hers was taking leave of them forever. When she got back into the drawing room, the others were on the move.
"Then you can come part of the way in my taxi."
"I shall be so thankful not to have to face another drive alone after my dreadful experience." "You can get a taxi at the rank just at the end of the street. You won't have to walk more than a few yards."
"That's a comfort. I'll go and put on my coat."
Miss Fulton moved towards the hall, and Bertha was following when Harry almost pushed past.
"Let me help you."
Bertha knew that he was repenting his rudeness. She let him go. What a boy he was in some ways, so impulsive, so simple. And Eddie and she were left by the fire.
"I wonder if you have seen Bilk's new poem called Table d'Hôte," said Eddie softly. "It's so wonderful, in the last anthology. Have you got a copy? I'd so like to show it to you. It begins with an incredibly beautiful line. Why must it always be tomato soup?"
"Yes," said Bertha. And she moved noiselessly to a table opposite the drawing-room door, and Eddie glided noiselessly after her. She picked up the little book and gave it to him. They had not made a sound. While he looked it up, she turned her head towards the hall, and she saw Harry, with Miss Fulton's coat in his arms,
and Miss Fulton with her back turned to him and her head bent. He tossed the coat away, put his hands on her shoulders, and turned her violently to him. His lips said, "I adore you." And Miss Fulton laid her moonbeam fingers on his cheeks and smiled her sleepy smile. Harry's nostrils quivered, his lips curled back in a hideous grin, while he whispered, "Tomorrow." And with her eyelids, Miss Fulton said, "Yes."
"Here it is," said Eddie. "Why must it always be tomato soup? It's so deeply true, don't you feel? Tomato soup is so dreadfully eternal." "If you prefer," said Harry's voice, very loud from the hall, "I can phone you a cab to come to the door."
"Oh, no, it's not necessary," said Miss Fulton, and she came up to Bertha and gave her the slender fingers to hold. "Goodbye. Thank you so much."
"Goodbye," said Bertha.
Miss Fulton held her hand a moment longer.
"Your lovely pear tree," she murmured. And then she was gone, with Eddie following, like the black cat following the gray cat.
"I'll shut up shop,"
said Harry, extravagantly cool and collected.
"Your lovely pear tree, pear tree, pear tree."
Bertha simply ran over to the long windows.
"Oh, what is going to happen now?"
she cried. But the pear tree was as lovely as ever, and as full of flower, and as still. And now, Marriage a la Mode by Catherine Mansfield. On his way to the station, William remembered with a fresh pang of disappointment that he was taking nothing down to the kiddies. Poor little chaps. It was hard lines on them. Their first words always were, as they ran to greet him, "What have you got for me, Daddy?" And he had nothing. He would have to buy them some sweets at the station, but that was what he had done for the past four Saturdays. Their faces had fallen last time when they saw the same old boxes produced again. And Patty had said,
"I had red ribbing on mine before."
And Johnny had said,
"It's always pink on mine. I hate pink."
But what was William to do? The affair wasn't so easily settled. In the old days, of course, he would have taken a taxi off to a decent toy shop and chosen them something in 5 minutes. But nowadays they had Russian toys, French toys, Serbian toys, toys from God knows where. It was over a year since Isabel had scrapped the old donkeys and engines and so on because they were so dreadfully sentimental and so appallingly bad for the baby's sense of form. "It's so important," the new Isabel had explained, "that they should like the right things from the very beginning. It saves so much time later on. Really, if the poor pets have to spend their infant years staring at these horrors, one can imagine them growing up and asking to be taken to the Royal Academy." And she spoke as though a visit to the Royal Academy was certain immediate death to anyone.
"Well, I don't know," said William slowly. "When I was their age, I used to go to bed hugging an old towel with a knot in it."
The new Isabel looked at him, her eyes narrowing, her lips apart.
"Dear William, I'm sure you did."
She laughed in the new way. Sweets it would have to be, however, thought William gloomily, fishing in his pocket for change for the taxi man. And he saw the kiddies handing the boxes round. They were awfully generous little chaps, while Isabel's precious friends didn't hesitate to help themselves. What about fruit? William hovered before a stall just inside the station. What about a melon each? Would they have to share that too? Or a pineapple for Pad and a melon for Johnny? Isabel's friends could hardly go sneaking up to the nursery at the children's meal times. All the same, as he bought the melon, William had a horrible vision of one of Isabel's young poets lapping up a slice, for some reason, behind the nursery door. With his two very awkward parcels, he strode off to his train. The platform was crowded. The train was in. Doors banged open and shut. There came such a loud hissing from the engine that people looked dazed as they scurried to and fro. William made straight for first-class smoker, stowed away his suitcase and parcels, and taking a huge wad of paper out of his inner pocket, he flung down in the corner
and began to read.
Our client, moreover, is positive. We are inclined to reconsider in the event of...
Ah, that was better. William pressed back his flattened hair and stretched his legs across the carriage floor. The familiar dull gnawing in his breast quieted down.
With regard to our decision...
He took out a blue pencil and scored a paragraph, slowly. Two men came in, stepped across him, and made for the farther corner. A young fellow swung his golf clubs into the rack and sat down opposite. The train gave a gentle lurch. They were off. William glanced up and saw the hot, bright station slipping away. A red-faced girl ran alongside the carriage. There was something strained and almost desperate in the way she waved and called.
Hysterical, thought William, dully.
Then a greasy black-faced workman at the end of the platform grinned at the passing train, and William thought, a filthy life, and went back to his papers. When he looked up again, there were fields and beasts standing for shelter under the dark trees. A wide river with naked children splashing in the shallows glided into sight and was gone again. The sky shone pale, and one bird drifted high like a dark fleck in a jewel.
We have examined our client's correspondence files.
The last sentence he had read echoed in his mind.
We have examined.
William hung on to that sentence, but it was no good. It snapped in the middle, and the fields, the sky, the sailing bird, the water all said, Isabel. The same thing happened every Saturday afternoon. When he was on his way to meet Isabel, there began those countless imaginary meetings. She was at the station, standing just a little apart from everybody else. She was sitting in the open taxi outside. She was at the garden gate, walking across the parched grass, at the door, or just inside the hall. And her clear, light voice said, It's William! Or, Hello, William! Or, So William has come! He touched her cool hand, her cool cheek. The exquisite freshness of Isabel. When he had been a little boy, it was his delight to run into the garden after a shower of rain and shake the rosebush over him. Isabel was that rosebush, petals soft, sparkling and cool. He was still that little boy, but there was no running into the garden now, no laughing and shaking. The dull, persistent gnawing in his breast started again. He drew up his legs, tossed the papers aside, and shut his eyes.
What is it, Isabel? What is it?
He said tenderly. They were in their bedroom, in the new house. Isabel sat on a painted stool before the dressing table that was strewn with little black and green boxes.
What is what, William?
And she bent forward, and her fine light hair fell over her cheeks.
Ah, you know.
He stood in the middle of the room, and he felt a stranger. At that, Isabel wheeled round quickly and faced him.
Oh, William,
she cried imploringly, and she held up the hairbrush.
Please, please don't be so dreadfully stuffy and tragic. You're always saying or looking or hinting that I've changed, just because I've got to know really congenial people and go about more, and I'm frightfully keen on everything. You behave as though I'd...
Isabel tossed back her hair and laughed.
Killed our love or something. It's so awfully absurd.
She bit her lip.
And it's so maddening, William. Even this new house and the servants you grudge me.
Isabel.
Yes, yes, it's true in a way, said Isabel quickly. You think they are another bad sign. Oh, I know you do. I feel it, she said softly. Every time you come up the stairs. But we couldn't have gone on living in that poky little hole, William. Be practical, at least. Why, there wasn't enough room for the babies, even.
No, it was true. Every morning when he came back from chambers, it was to find the babies with Isabel in the back drawing room. They were having rides on the leopard skin thrown over the sofa back. Or they were playing shops with Isabel's desk for a counter. Or Pad was sitting on the hearth rug rowing away for dear life with a little brass fire shovel, while Johnny shot at pirates with the tongs. Every evening they each had a piggyback up the narrow stairs to their fat old nanny. Yes, he supposed it was a poky little house. A little white house with blue curtains and a window box of petunias. William met their friends at the door with,
"See our petunias? Pretty terrific for London, don't you think?"
But the imbecile thing, the absolutely extraordinary thing, was that he hadn't the slightest idea that Isabel wasn't as happy as he. God, what blindness! He hadn't the remotest notion in those days that she really hated that inconvenient little house, that she thought the fat nanny was ruining the babies, that she was desperately lonely, pining for new people and new music and pictures and so on. If they hadn't gone to that studio party with Maura Morrison, if Maura Morrison hadn't said as they were leaving,
"I'm going to rescue your wife, selfish man. She's like an exquisite little Tatiana."
If Isabel hadn't gone with Maura to Paris. If. The train stopped at another station, Beddingford. Good heavens, they'd be there in 10 minutes. William stuffed the papers back into his pockets. The young man opposite had long since disappeared. Now the other two got out. The late afternoon sun shone on women in cotton frocks and little sunburnt barefoot children. It blazed on a silky yellow flower with coarse leaves, which sprawled over a bank of rock. The air ruffling through the window smelled of the sea. Had Isabel the same crowd with her this weekend? Wondered William. And he remembered the holidays they used to have, the four of them, with a little farm girl, Rose, to look after the babies. Isabel wore a jersey, and her hair in a plait. She looked about 14. Lord, how his nose used to peel! And the amount they ate, and the amount they slept in that immense featherbed with their feet locked together. William couldn't help a grim smile as he thought of Isabel's horror if she knew the extent of his sentimentality.
"Hello, William."
She was at the station after all, standing just as he had imagined, apart from the others. And William's heart leapt. She was alone.
"Hello, Isabel."
William stared. He thought she looked so beautiful that he had to say something.
"You look very cool."
"Do I?" said Isabel. "I don't feel very cool. Come along. Your horrid old train is late. The taxi's outside."
She put her hand tightly on his arm as they passed the ticket collector.
"We've all come to meet you," she said, "but we've left Bobby Kane at the sweet shop to be called for."
"Oh,"
said William. It was all he could say for the moment. There in the glare waited the taxi, with Bill Hunt and Dennis Green sprawling on one side, their hats tilted over their faces, while on the other, Maura Morrison, in a bonnet like a huge strawberry, jumped up and down.
"No ice, no ice, no ice!"
she shouted gaily. And Dennis chimed in from under his hat.
"Only to be had from the fishmongers."
And Bill Hunt, emerging, added,
"With whole fish in it."
"Oh, what a bore!"
wailed Isabel. And she explained to William how they had been chasing around the town for ice while she waited for him.
"Simply everything is running down the steep cliffs into the sea, beginning with the butter."
"We shall have to anoint ourselves with butter," said Dennis. "May thy head, William, lack not ointment."
"Look here," said William. "How are we going to sit? I'd better get up by the driver."
"No, Bobby Kane's by the driver," said Isabel. "You're to sit between Maura and me."
The taxi started.
"What have you got in those mysterious parcels?"
"Decapitated heads,"
said Bill Hunt, shuddering beneath his hat.
"Oh, fruit!"
Isabel sounded very pleased.
"Wise William, a melon and a pineapple. How too nice!"
"No, wait a bit,"
said William, smiling, but he really was anxious.
"I brought them down for the kiddies."
"Oh, my dear,"
Isabel laughed and slipped her hand through his arm.
"They'd be rolling in agony if they were to eat them. No,"
she patted his hand,
"you must bring them something next time. I refuse to part with my pineapple."
"Cruel Isabel, do let me smell it," said Maura.
She flung her arms across William appealingly.
"Oh!"
The strawberry bonnet fell forward. She sounded quite faint.
"A lady in love with a pineapple,"
said Dennis, as the taxi drew up before a little shop with a striped blind. Out came Bobby Kane, his arms full of little packets.
"I do hope they're good. I've chosen them because of the colors. There are some round things which really look too divine,
And just look at this nougat," he cried ecstatically. "Just look at it! It's a perfect little ballet!"
And at that moment the shopman appeared.
"Oh, I forgot. They're none of them paid for,"
said Bobby, looking frightened. Isabel gave the shopman a note, and Bobby was radiant again.
"Hello, William. I'm sitting by the driver."
And bareheaded, all in white, with his sleeves rolled up to the shoulders, he leaped into his place.
"Avanti!" he cried.
After tea, the others went off to bathe, while William stayed and made his peace with the kiddies. But Johnny and Patty were asleep. The rose-red glow had paled, bats were flying, and still the bathers had not returned. As William wandered downstairs, the maid crossed the hall carrying a lamp. He followed her into the sitting room. It was a long room, colored yellow. On the wall opposite William, someone had painted a young man, over life-size, with very wobbly legs, offering a wide-eyed daisy to a young woman who had one very short arm and one very long, thin one. Over the chairs and sofa there hung strips of black material, covered with big splashes like broken eggs, and everywhere one looked there seemed to be an ashtray full of cigarette ends. William sat down in one of the armchairs. Nowadays, when one felt with one hand down the sides, it wasn't to come upon a sheep with three legs or a cow that had lost one horn or a very fat dove out of Noah's Ark. One fished up yet another little paper-covered book of smudged-looking poems. He thought of the wad of paper in his pockets, but he was too hungry and tired to read. The door was open. Sounds came from the kitchen. The servants were talking as if they were alone in the house. Suddenly there came a loud screech of laughter and an equally loud shh. They had remembered him. William got up and went through the French doors into the garden, and as he stood there in the shadow, he heard the bathers coming up the sandy road. Their voices rang through the quiet.
"I think it's up to Mora to use her little arts and wiles."
A tragic moan from Mora.
"We ought to have a gramophone for the weekends that played the Maid of the Mountains."
"Oh, no, oh, no," cried Isabel's voice. "That's not fair to William. Be nice to him, my children. He's only staying until tomorrow evening."
"Leave it to me," cried Bobby Kane. "I'm awfully good at looking after people."
The gate swung open and shut. William moved on the terrace. They had seen him.
"Hello, William."
And Bobby Kane, flapping his towel, began to leap and pirouette on the parched lawn.
"Pity you didn't come, William. The water was divine. And we all went to the little pub afterwards and had a slow gin."
The others had reached the house.
"I say, Isabel," called Bobby, "would you like me to wear my Nijinsky dress tonight?"
"No," said Isabel. "Nobody's going to dress. We're all starving. William's starving, too. Come along, mes amis. Let's begin with sardines."
"I have found the sardines," said Mora,
and she ran into the hall, holding a box high in the air.
"A lady with a box of sardines," said Dennis gravely. "Well, William, and how's London?"
asked Bill Hunt, drawing the cork out of a bottle of whiskey.
"Oh, London's not much changed," answered William. "Good old London," said Bobby, very hearty, spearing a sardine.
But a moment later, William was forgotten. Mora Morrison began wondering what color one's legs really were under water.
"Mine are the palest, palest mushroom color."
Bill and Dennis ate enormously, and Isabel filled glasses and changed plates and found matches, smiling blissfully. At one moment she said,
"I do wish, Bill, you'd paint it."
"Paint what?"
said Bill loudly, stuffing his mouth with bread.
"Us," said Isabel, "round the table. It would be so fascinating in 20 years' time."
Bill screwed up his eyes and chewed.
"Light's wrong," he said rudely. "Far too much yellow."
And went on eating. And that seemed to charm Isabel, too. But after supper, they were all so tired they could do nothing but yawn until it was late enough to go to bed. It was not until William was waiting for his taxi the next afternoon that he found himself alone with Isabel. When he brought his suitcase down into the hall, Isabel left the others and went over to him. She stooped down and picked up the suitcase.
"What a weight!" she said, and gave a little awkward laugh. "Let me carry it. To the gate?"
"No, why should you?"
said William.
Of course not. Give it to me.
Oh, please do let me, said Isabel. I want to, really.
They walked together silently. William felt there was nothing to say now.
There, said Isabel triumphantly, setting the suitcase down, and she looked anxiously along the sandy road. I hardly seem to have seen you this time, she said breathlessly. It's so short, isn't it? I feel you've only just come. Next time.
The taxi came into sight.
I hope they look after you properly in London. I'm so sorry the babies have been out all day, but Miss Neal had arranged it. They'll hate missing you. Poor William, going back to London.
The taxi turned.
Goodbye.
She gave him a little hurried kiss. She was gone. Fields, trees, hedges streamed by. They shook through the empty, blind-looking little town, ground up the steep pull to the station. The train was in. William made straight for a first-class smoker, flung back into the corner, but this time he let the papers alone. He folded his arms against the dull, persistent gnawing and began in his mind to write a letter to Isabel. The post was late as usual. They sat outside the house in long chairs under colored parasols. Only Bobby Kane lay on the turf at Isabel's feet. It was dull, stifling. The day drooped like a flag.
"Do you think there will be Mondays in heaven?" asked Bobby childishly.
And Dennis murmured,
"Heaven will be one long Monday."
But Isabel couldn't help wondering what had happened to the salmon they had for supper last night. She had meant to have fish mayonnaise for lunch. And now, Maura was asleep. Sleeping was her latest discovery.
"It's so wonderful. One simply shuts one's eyes. That's all. It's so delicious."
When the old ruddy postman came beating along the sandy road on his tricycle, one felt the handlebars ought to have been oars. Bill Hunt put down his book.
"Letters,"
he said complacently, and they all waited. But heartless postman, oh, malignant world, there was only one.
Well, fat one for Isabel.
Not even a paper.
"And mine's only from William," said Isabel mournfully.
"From William? Already? He's sending you back your marriage lines as a gentle reminder."
"Does everybody have marriage lines? I thought they were only for servants."
"Pages and pages. Look at her. A lady reading a letter," said Dennis.
"My darling, precious Isabel."
Pages and pages there were. As Isabel read on, her feeling of astonishment changed to a stifled feeling. What on earth had induced William? How extraordinary it was! What could have made him? She felt confused, more and more excited, and even frightened. It was just like William. Was it? It was absurd, of course. It must be absurd, ridiculous.
Ha 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 ha! Oh, dear!
What was she to do? Isabel flung back in her chair and laughed till she couldn't stop laughing.
"Do tell us," said the others. "You must tell us."
"I'm longing to," gurgled Isabel.
She sat up, gathered the letter, and waved it at them.
"Gather round," she said. "Listen, it's too marvelous. A love letter."
"A love letter? But how divine! Darling, precious Isabel."
But she had hardly begun before their laughter interrupted her.
"Go on, Isabel, it's perfect."
"It's the most marvelous find."
"Oh, do go on, Isabel."
"God forbid, my darling, that I should be a drag on your happiness."
"Oh, oh, oh,
shh, shh, shh."
And Isabel went on. When she reached the end, they were hysterical. Bobby rolled on the turf and almost sobbed.
"You must let me have it just as it is, entire for my new book," said Dennis firmly. "I shall give it a whole chapter."
"Oh, Isabel," moaned Maura, "that wonderful bit about holding you in his arms."
"I always thought those letters in divorce cases were made up, but they pale before this." "Let me hold it. Let me read it my own self," said Bobby Kane.
But to their surprise, Isabel crushed the letter in her hand. She was laughing no longer. She glanced quickly at them all. She looked exhausted.
"No, not just now,"
she stammered. And before they could recover, she had run into the house, through the hall, up the stairs into her bedroom. Down she sat on the side of the bed.
How vile, odious, abominable, vulgar, muttered Isabel.
She pressed her eyes with her knuckles and rocked to and fro, and again she saw them, but not four, more like 40, laughing, sneering, jeering, stretching out their hands, while she read them William's letter. Oh, what a loathsome thing to have done! How could she have done it?
God forbid, my darling, that I should be a drag on your happiness. William!
Isabel pressed her face into the pillow, but she felt that even the grave bedroom knew her for what she was, shallow, tinkling, vain. Presently from the garden below there came voices.
Isabel, we're all going for a bathe. Do come!
Come, thou wife of William!
Call her once before you go. Call once yet!
Isabel sat up. Now was the moment. Now she must decide. Would she go with them, or stay here and write to William?
Which should it be? I must make up my mind. Oh, but how could there be any question? Of course she would stay here and write.
Titania!
Piped Mora.
Isabel!
No, it was too difficult.
I'll go with them and write to William later, some other time, later, not now. But I shall certainly write, thought Isabel hurriedly.
And laughing in the new way, she ran down the stairs. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed Bliss and Marriage a la Mode by Catherine Mansfield. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.